for coming. It is bright and early, and this is supposed to be a panel on writing your dream book. So I think a lot of us wish we were still having that dream in our darkened hotel rooms. I think that all of us, or a lot of people, right, doesn't everyone have kind of a secret fantasy to write a book? It's a very alluring kind of goal. There's a sense that you can go deep into a topic you're passionate about. You can spend a lot of time in something and sort of get away from the daily grind of your deadlines, even if they're magazine deadlines. And, of course, book writing can also be a grind, but it's a grind of your own making. And I think somehow that makes it much more palatable. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that we love the idea of writing a book is because of the sort of implied freedom, you know, that we can sort of go off on our own and do something we're so attached to personally. But I think that freedom is also complicated because there is an inherent tension between sometimes what we want to spend years working on and what a lot of people want to buy in this marketplace. And the marketplace, if anything, is getting more challenging. There's more and more attention for people's time. Of course, the good news is people are still buying books. I have this funny theory, though, that they're not actually reading them. It doesn't really matter as long as they're buying them. That's my feeling. So there's this inherent tension. And I think the reality is, what it comes down to is that it's harder for writers to make the decision about whether it's really worth doing. The calculus is really difficult economically, and it's difficult sort of in a time management frame. We don't get huge advances for environmental books, and the sort of days of the big advance are really, they're gone. I think it is still possible to get a decent advance, but by the time you divide it by the number of years you spend writing your book, and then you deduct what you give to your agent, and you take out your taxes. And in my case, and I think this is probably true for a lot of people, we expense our own reporting if that comes out of our advance. I hired a research assistant for part of my book, and I also had to buy the photos in my book. All that, you know, it's like ching, ching, ching. It all comes out. So I didn't really introduce myself. I'm sorry. I'm Florence Williams, and I'm the author of Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History, which was published in May by W.W. Norton. So I'd like to introduce our panelists, and I think I'll just introduce them one at a time as they talk. And my first question for them is really how they made the decision to write their book, their dream book, because how did they make the calculus work for them? And how did they become convinced that it was worthwhile? And I'm very curious to hear this, too, because I'd like to figure out whether I'm going to do another book, and I'm still struggling with whether the calculus really makes sense, especially in this kind of changing market where there's so much competition and less money, frankly. Okay, so Joe Roman is a conservation biologist who teaches at the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics at the University of Vermont. He's the author of Whale and Listed, Dispatches from America's Endangered Species Act, which was the winner of this year's SEJ's Rachel Carson Environmental Book Award.
Thanks, and good morning, everyone. I just thought of this line that I interviewed someone who's a biologist down in Brazil earlier this year and asked him about his plans for his research. He studies dolphins there. He said, I have no plans, just opportunities. That basically he followed that path to studying dolphins there. And I realized that's probably the same thing for me in writing Listed and in writing Whale. Listed came about in part by chance. I reviewed a book for Harvard University Press and just got to talking with the acquisitions editor there, and we met for lunch, and then, you know, eventually that led to a contract. I didn't use an agent. It wasn't a big advance. You know, it's an academic press, which is one alternative, one way to go about it. I think academic presses are publishing a lot of stuff that more commercial presses used to do in the past. The topic was more than opportunistic for me. It's something I've been interested in since as long as I can remember. I can remember seeing a snail darter in the Daily News. I grew up in New York when I was a little kid, and that story really resonated. I couldn't imagine that people would potentially let a species go extinct, but that we would make a decision. So that's something I've been interested in. I've worked in various fields. I've worked at both as an editor and mostly as a scientist for the past 10 years. Setting aside the time for this book was incredibly challenging because I'm also a researcher. And so my research really had to be put aside for a couple of years, besides the fact that a two-year-old passed. So it was a product of opportunity, but also passion for me. That when we had discussed the options and ideas, it was clear that that was that endangered species was something I had been interested in for basically for my whole life. Beyond that, there were a lot of things happening around that time when we had that conversation. Richard Pombo was in Congress, and he changed the Endangered Species Act in the House, and the Senate was considering making changes as well. And there had been a response in North Carolina to they were going to be listing red-cockaded woodpeckers in this area, putting regulations in. The response in the town was to go out and get every chainsaw every chainsaw in the county was purchased in that time and just cut down all the long beach pines in that town. Those were the two stories that sort of sparked why I wanted to start this book.
Okay, thanks, Joe. Next up, we have Lizzie Grossman. She's the author of Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry, and High-Tech Trash, Digital Devices, Hidden Toxins, and Human Health, and Watershed, The Undamming of America. I think there's another book in there, too, but we'll start with those. She's also the co-editor of Shadow Cat, Encountering the American Mountain Lion. Her writing has appeared in Mother Jones, The Nation, Salon, The Washington Post, and other publications. She lives in Portland, Oregon. She's also a former literary agent, so I think she'll have some perspective there. And I've been a fan of hers for a really long time. I'm really thrilled she's on my panel.
Well, thank you so much, Florence, and I would say likewise, because there have been a number of publications that I have sent pitches to, and they said, oh, we can't do that. Florence Williams is writing for us. But thank you. And I think I started out writing books in a really different way than other people do, because I began freelancing full-time in 1999, and I actually started knowing that one of the things I was going to do was write a book. Okay, is that better? Can you hear me now? Okay. Anyway, I started off freelancing full-time in 1999, and one of the first pieces I did was, I don't know if any of you remember, back then, the Patagonia catalog had actual essays by writers, and I had a friend who was editing for them, and she knew I had just started freelancing, and so she asked if I would write an essay about dam removal, because they wanted to have something about people taking conservation responsibility for the places that they went to play in the water. And I very quickly realized that there were so many stories around this issue that it would easily make a book. And given my background working in book publishing, I just sort of had this mindset of how I would put together a book proposal. And that was almost the first thing I did when I started freelancing, because I was writing for a lot of really small publications that didn't pay me very much money. And I just thought, I'm just going to go for it. And I don't have an agent. I can't even imagine who would want to take me on as a client because my book topics are so obscure. And I just decided that that would be the organizing principle for my work, and it was actually doing all that research on water that eventually, oddly, led me to write High-Tech Trash, because I ended up doing a water quality kind of report for a local riverkeeper group back around 2001, 2002, and it turned out, I live in Portland, Oregon, main river is the Willamette, it turned out that the majority of the toxics release inventory pollutants going into the Willamette River system at that time were coming from high-tech and related industries. And I was just completely flabbergasted by this information and then just started following that thread and again realized this was way too big for an article. So I needed to write a book. And that has continued to be my organizing principle. And I will say that my last book came out in 2009, and then I did some updating for it for the paperback that came out in 2011. And I think since then, the publishing landscape has changed so radically that I'm now slowly starting to work on a next book. But I feel that given all the changes in the market, that the ante has really been up to figure out how I write a book that someone would actually bother to go out and buy rather than just read a chapter of online. And maybe we can talk a little bit more about that later.
Okay, thanks, Lizzie. Michael Kodas is a photojournalist, author, and videographer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, Boston Globe, Newsweek, CBS Evening News, among other places. In 1999, he was part of the team at the Hartford Courant, awarded the Pulitzer Prize for breaking news coverage. He's the author of High Crimes, The Fate of Everest in an Age of Greed. From 1987 until 2008, he was a staff photographer, picture editor, and writer at the Hartford Courant. In 2009, he was awarded a Ted Scripps Fellowship in Environmental Journalism. And he's currently working on a book about megafire. So he's got one book out and one book he's currently cooking.
Yeah, cooking. That's a good word for it. So, yeah, I'm a newspaper guy. And I'd worked on a couple of earlier book projects like, Guides to the Appalachian Trail and things like that. And most of my projects, in fact, all of my projects grew out of things that I had, that were shorter term pieces for the newspapers I worked for. So the Everest book, I had a neighbor who knew my outdoor coverage. I kind of had this envious position for maybe 10 years where once a year we'd do a big outdoor project. And so for 2 or 3 months, I'd hike the Appalachian Trail or paddle a sea kayak around Long Island Sound, which were really conduits to do environmental stories. But, you know, you could get readers to pick up the paper and see if I'd managed to drown myself. And then maybe in their research as to whether I was still employed, they'd be able to find out something about Long Island Sound. And so one day I had a neighbor. I have a neighbor back in Connecticut, or I did, who with his wife had climbed Everest 15 times, and I knew who he was. He's this Romanian-American character, and I ran into him by my house, and he invited me onto this Everest expedition, and I never really thought the paper would send me, although I'm a climber, and I pitched it, and they bought into it. I think I really underestimated, during the last decade how far a newspaper would go to get somebody off of staff. So I went on this Everest expedition, and this person who had invited me, who I'd written quite a bit about in the U.S., but had never really been able to find the people he'd climbed with and done things with in Romania, proved to be this crazy character who was, beating his wife on the mountain and stealing gear and cutting ropes, and, it went from bad to worse, and I'm writing all this stuff. He ended up stalking us when we came back to the States, and it just went on and on, and so, the first book, kind of in that downward spiral of this story going really horribly awry, writing a book just seemed like the next step. So anyway, I'd written a newspaper series on this and then a magazine piece, and met my agent at the Nieman Narrative Writing Conference when that was still going on at Harvard, basically just sitting over breakfast at something like this. It was really crowded, and there were two seats. I ended up sitting next to my agent, who had just left Houghton Mifflin as an executive there, and opened a small agency. And she really liked my work. It probably took 6 months of emails and stuff back and forth, both to kind of put a point on what I wanted to do with this book, and also negotiate with the newspaper to allow me to write this book, because I'd been on contract with them when I did the initial work. And so. So that was that turned into the first book. The book on megafire, another one of my summer projects at the Current maybe 10 years ago, after some really bad fire seasons in the West, I was in Connecticut, and Connecticut doesn't really have a wildfire problem. I mean, we have fires, but they're not that significant. And I had some sources at the Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection, or the equivalent of the Department of Environmental Protection in Connecticut, who were going to be away in the summer. When I asked what they were doing, they go, "Oh, well, we go out west and fight wildfires every year." And I thought, "Well, wow, how does that work? That you're a state employee, but you're working for the feds on these fires?" And it turns out that pretty much every state in the country, even ones that don't have a fire problem, are training wildland firefighters on the state dime, and then making them available to the federal call-up because they just needed so many bodies in the last 10 years to fight these fires. And I wanted to get access to that, and really couldn't get the kind of access I wanted unless I joined them. So I went through their training program, and I spent a summer working as a seasonal wildland firefighter with this crew of guys from Connecticut that would fly out to fires in Colorado and Wyoming. And that has kind of continued where we're I learned that we're actually sending wildland firefighters now overseas, and we've had, Black Sunday in Australia and fires in the Mediterranean and in Russia. And so I just got really curious about how does this work that, we've got these firefighters going all over the world now effectively, and that we have this, interesting global problem. And so I'd done the story for The Current and was able to kind of, again, volley that into kind of a bigger picture story. So that's basically those two books. Basically it's really just kind of a long shopping list of bad judgment.
Can everyone hear the panelists okay? No. Okay. So panelists, please get a little closer. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask some questions, and then I want to leave plenty of time.
How did I know it was a book? Well, I think each one of my books, it was really clear that if I was going to encompass everything that I wanted to put in there, in the case of the dam removal book, there were dams being removed all over the country. Each river was a completely different character. There was a different set of issues involved. The geographies were different, and I wanted to give the whole scope of the picture. And there was no way that you could cram all of that into a single article unless it was some little bullet-pointed survey. When I started working on the high-tech trash book, I did send it to a friend who's a writer and a journalist who's written quite a number of books, and he said, I don't think there's enough in there for more than an article. But once I started poking around and decided that I wanted to write about the environmental and health impacts of the entire life cycle of high-tech electronics, from raw materials through manufacturing to what happens when we dispose of this stuff, it was beyond clear that there was more than enough material for a book. And similarly, when I started working on Chasing Molecules, which I personally would have called something else, and maybe we can talk about that in the post-publication thing, what happens to your title, I wrote that book because while I was working on high-tech trash, I was introduced to the world of environmentally mobile, persistent, pervasive synthetic chemicals. And at that point, I was still printing out journal articles rather than saving them all as PDFs. And my office, which is an ungodly mess, was literally knee-deep in articles about brominated flame retardants and perfluorinated compounds and plastics chemicals. And I had also met all these scientists who were working on those chemicals. And at the same time, I'd met the scientists who were working on green chemistry and design for environment, environmental health things, and I just thought they were so phenomenally interesting, as I did the people who were advocating for better processes for e-waste, and I thought, these people are just such phenomenal characters, and they're doing such interesting work. I can't leave them behind. I want to tag along and see what they're doing. So I just kind of thought, I have no idea what's going to happen. I definitely will spend a lot of my own meager money doing this, but it just seemed to me it was a really important topic to try to wrap my arms around. And I will say, I don't have an agent, partly because I think because I was an agent, and I know how long agents can take to make decisions, and how cautious they are about wanting to sell things that are actually going to make them and their firm some money, which is also partly why I'm no longer an agent. That I thought, I'm too impatient. I'm just going to cut the middleman out of this equation and just go for it. And I will also say that even though I had a background in book publishing, I actually had never cashed in a single, like, friend favor. I sent my book to people who I actually didn't know at all, but I knew they published books like the one I wanted to publish. And the person who ended up being my editor for my last two books, a wonderful man named Jonathan Cobb, who was at Island Press, I met him completely by chance at a conference. He was standing behind a table with, books from Island Press, and we just said hello, and he said, would you ever consider doing a book with us? And I said, I didn't even know you gave advances. And we went back and forth a lot on the Chasing Molecules book to figure out which direction it was going to go and if it was really a book. But I think it was just the idea that there was so much to wrap your arms around that there was no way that you could winnow it down into an article. So,
I guess on the first book, I wrote the newspaper stories and leading up to a big magazine takeout, Sunday magazine takeout, basically I had this character who, had kind of stalked us, and I ended up turning back from the summit of Mount Everest with this guy threatening me and the leader of the expedition and beating his wife and all kinds of horrible things. And I had my magazine piece that kind of was the investigation into this guy's history and several other people and kind of years of this stuff. And the week after my Sunday magazine piece ran, there was a piece in the Washington Post about a doctor from Washington, D.C., who had climbed on the other side of Mount Everest, and on the day that I turned back from the summit, he had summited and then vanished. And they had this investigation into this character he had hired as a guide, who had basically swindled him out of a lot of money and gotten him killed and tried to hide it. And I kind of thought, wow, if that's all happening on the same day, this is not just like one horrible event. This is kind of a trend. And I'd never really thought I was going to write a book about that. And I'm a climber, but I'd never had any interest in climbing Mount Everest. But I was really fascinated by just the cultural, sociological things that are going on there. And I guess, it was really my first book like that. But what I was really looking for is kind of two things. And one is the topic. Is the topic one of these things that's just so surprising that people are just going to go, what? Crime on Mount Everest, I never thought about that. And the other thing then is, do you have the narrative and the characters that are going to be able to tell that story? Because that's really what the publishing world wants in a book now. No matter how great the topic is, they just keep coming back to, but narrative. Where's the narrative? Where are the characters? And so it took a little while to really research this and think that I had all of that for the first book. And so the book I'm working on now, I've had this experience, and I don't know about the rest of you. And I totally understand Lizzie's point of view. I love my agent. I really like editing, and my agent has got a very small stable of writers and is incredibly hands-on. She'd been an editor, and I like that. There's very much a back and forth, and it's somebody I can pretty much call out of the blue and like send a chapter to, and she'll read it and get back to me that I think this fits or not. And so I find that give and take and working on the book proposal, which I work a really long, book proposals are basically, the way I see it, you're writing a book about the book you want to write. And in that process is where I find out whether I've got a book or not. And I wrote two book proposals before I got this one, where I thought, oh, wow, this is the one. And the previous two, I got to, maybe three quarters of the way done, and I'm actually sending it to my agent and going back and forth. And then we have this conversation going, I think I wrote a book proposal to discover that this isn't a book. So that's kind of my process.
Okay, thanks. You both mentioned, Lizzie and Michael, that there have been changes in the publishing industry. And I mentioned that too. I didn't really get specific, but I'm wondering if maybe you two can both share your perspective on what has changed and how you have positioned yourselves, to sort of take advantage of that, or to kind of, sort of ignore it or override it. What's changed and what do you do?
Well, the first thing that's coming to my mind, and I should have printed it out and put it on a slide or something, there's a piece that came out in October 2009 in the New Yorker's Shouts and Murmurs section that was called Our Marketing Plan by Ellis Weiner, and I thought it was written for me, because Chasing Molecules had come out a week before, and it is this, I laugh out loud every time I read it, it is this sort of parody of a letter from a publicity agent to an author, please get yourself on Twitter. You may not know you are on Facebook, but we want you blogging 24 hours a day, etc. And I can't say that I have positioned myself to do anything, but I think one of the things that's changed enormously from the time Watershed came out, and certainly when the Mountain Lion anthology came out in 1999 to 2009, is the independent bookstore. And books like ours, environmental books, books of nonfiction that are not forecast to be blockbusters because they're not Hillary Clinton's As Told to the Pope diet book or something. It was the independent bookstores that really liked our books. And they would look at a book like Michael's or Joe's or say, we know who our wildlife fans are. We know who our women's issues fans are. We know who our climbing and outdoor people are. We'll send them out a note and we'll get them in for this reading. And by 2009, Island Press didn't want to send me to a single bookstore. They wanted to find me these big events. And I'm thinking, me at the Commonwealth Club? Are you sure anybody will show up? But I know if you send me to Powell's or Village Books in Bellingham, where I actually personally don't know a single person, they will have 60 people in there, and I will guarantee you they will sell that whole box of 20 books. But if you don't send me there, that won't happen. So I think that's one of the enormous changes that has happened. Personally, I've kind of ignored the online stuff so far because the e-book, Island Press, hadn't really sort of meshed with that. But I think the whole publicity thing completely changed. Book reviews. The book review sections disappeared completely between, 2006 and 2009 or 10. They're gone. So you can't get a local book review. So that's really, really different. And just how people learn about books, I think the publishers are really still at sea. They don't really quite know what they're doing. So I think that's one of the biggest things that changed. And one of the things that I still don't really have a grip on is how publishers are thinking about the books they acquire in this new landscape, or if they're thinking about it at all, because I just don't think they're that strategic about it. But I think the really two big things were the independent bookstores disappearing and the book review sections and publishers not really knowing how they were going to respond. So I don't know what your thoughts are.
Well, I guess, I'll start by pointing out that, my current publisher, although it hasn't affected me, is in bankruptcy. So, I'm pretty sympathetic that.
I just have to add to the, never mind the bankruptcy. I take this stuff so for granted. Watershed came out, and like a week later, my publisher, who was Jack Shoemaker, famous of North Point Press and Counterpoint Press, the whole thing folded, and they were acquired by somebody else. And when I called up, they said, who are you? My editor at Island Press lost his job, and the imprint was canceled like a month after I turned in my manuscript. So I just want to add that into the mix. So,
yeah. And that really played with my last book. I ended up an orphan. Which basically means that the people who bought your project, which were the editor-in-chief and the president of Hyperion, had left within a month of my book coming out, and suddenly the publicity funding just dried up. And it was really pretty fascinating to me, because I would complain, I cannot believe this, because Powell's wanted me to come out. I had all these book talks and people contacting me directly from very big operations, and I was doing pretty well at book talks. I mean, I was selling enough to pay for the talks, and they would push back so hard about not wanting to do events or send me anywhere. And then I would complain to other authors, and they would go, oh my God, you are getting so much better treatment than we are. Shut up. So that was really surprising to me. The events that they did want to do were almost never at bookstores. They, wanted to send me to Outfitters or to, the Himalayan Museum and things like that. And those events went well. I was really surprised because, I have a couple inherent advantages going into this, and one being that, I'm kind of a multimedia journalist, and we can talk a little bit later about some of the things that I do with that, but I have this incredible group, you know, not that the material is that great or anything, but, you know, I have a ton of photography and videography and audio interviews, and I can put together a multimedia presentation, and you can get a lot of people to come out and come to, a multimedia show about crime on Mount Everest who have no intention of buying a book. And if you play it just right, a couple of them might. And so, you know, it wasn't like, there wasn't a lot for them to be marketing me on, and yet it was really a wrestling match to get them to agree to events. And the other advantage I have is that I've worked in the newspaper business for so long, and so I just know a lot of people, and I had a lot of very small chips I could cash in, and so I just kind of network with all my old friends and people I went to college with, and that got me a lot of reviews and a lot of radio time, and that helped a lot, and that was something that I think helped a lot with events. Was that I would contact the local radio stations and NPR affiliates a few weeks before I was going to come out, or if I was just traveling, like, for the first year I had this last book out, I was still working for The Current, and so I'd have assignments, around the country. And as soon as I knew, I mean, even if I was just getting sent to, a basketball game or something, as soon as I knew I was getting sent to a town or city, I'd immediately look up who do I know there and what are the radio programs there, and I'd contact them. And lots of times it didn't necessarily lead to an event, but I almost always had at least some short spot on public radio or something like that, and I found that to be really helpful. I guess it's a long way of saying that I was really surprised that they invested quite a bit in this project up front, and how little they were willing to invest, particularly after I was orphaned, in promoting it. And so you end up being your own promotions department. And, they're not terrific books, but if you are looking at doing this and you've got a book coming out, I really recommend maybe going to the library or a bookstore and, perhaps even buying the books about guerrilla marketing and just thumbing through some of the ideas in there, because some of them are really clever. And, you kind of have to work around this. Like I said, I'm with Houghton Mifflin Harcourt now, and they declared bankruptcy not that long ago. And so, it leaves all of us a little bit worried. And this advance was quite a bit smaller than my last advance. And I think that's the case with, everybody except John Grisham.
I've been wondering, I don't know if it works for you guys, I've probably made more money on Honoraria this year than from the book, actually from the royalty book itself. It may be because of my feet, because I'm an academic and I do conservation, but I don't know, I wondered if there would be a shift in writing, in publishing the way there has been in music, where, you're always on tour. Because that's where you're making your money. It's not necessarily from the album. I'm not making a ton of money on the book, so I don't know if there's a shift there. I don't know if you guys have seen it that way or not.
I have been asked to do a fair amount of talking, but it hasn't necessarily come with any honoraria. And if it has, it's usually on some very tiny fixed budget. Yeah, three figures.
I do want to talk more about that sort of strategic marketing that I think we're all doing. But before we totally jump to that, I'm also still interested in this kind of how you make it work economically in terms of the calculus of your advance. And I know that you've all been sort of creative here. I mean, Lizzie's gotten grants, and I think it would be cool to hear a little bit about how she did that. I think, Michael, you kind of, in some ways, I think, were really strategic in how you got your publisher to give you more money by offering to sort of deliver more in terms of multimedia in your next book, and I'd love you to talk about that. And then, Joe, I know you have still, you work two jobs, basically, when you're writing a book. For me, I think making my advance kind of worthwhile, I had to write the book, really efficiently. I was like, okay, I've got 2 years to write this book, and I had to stick to that in order to make it work. So,
for me, yeah. So I teach and I do research, and I had a 2-year-old when I was working on the book, and my wife was doing her PhD. So that meant 4 a.m. was most of work was really much. It was 4 to 7, or 4 until when my daughter woke up was pretty much my writing day. And then when I traveled was the other time that I could be productive when I was traveling for the book, gave me a chance to do that. One advantage I had is that the research I do is related to the topic that I was writing, and that actually helps me a little bit in promotion. as well in the after, because I have context. I have research coming out that is connected to the book in certain ways, and that's been one way to get some media attention. That's still, you know, now that the book's been out for over a year, I'm not getting calls about the book alone anymore. It's more, maybe if it's related to other projects that I've been doing.
I think Florence's comment about working efficiently, that's been one of my main operating principles. If I said I would do my book in 2 years, there's no way that I could actually make financial sense of my small advance by pushing it out any longer, because I figured the longer I took, the more other work I would have to do to continue to make that make sense. The first two books I did, and I did Between Watershed and High Tech Trash, Sierra Club Books, I knew an editor there, and I know I wasn't the first writer asked, called up and said, we want to do a Lewis and Clark Trail book for the Lewis and Clark Trail, Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, and I ended up doing that in between the other things, and that had a very small advance. But I worked off of my small advances, and whatever I could earn from magazine and newspaper work along the way for Watershed and the Lewis and Clark book. And then when I set out to do High Tech Trash, I realized if I really wanted to do this right, I was going to have to do a bunch of traveling. And I had a very modest advance, and I got half of it up front, which was less than $10,000, that first half. And I'm thinking, and I am my sole source of income. I don't have another income in my household, or any inheritance or anything. So I'm looking at this less than $10,000, and how am I going to do this? And I just started combing through every resource I could possibly find on the planet. And I will say, I went through all of the SEJ sort of resources, fellowships and grants, and I combed through everything. And mostly somebody wanted to send you to a wonderful academic program where you weren't supposed to do any work, or I found these things with, you know, a month in a cabin with no internet access somewhere, which wasn't really going to help me. And then, by some miracle, I found this. It was a MacArthur Foundation. No, it's not the Genius Grants. They had a short-term cycle of grants that they were giving to people not affiliated with 501c3s. And one of the areas was global security and sustainability. And I thought I could make a case for my topic. And they had a blessedly easy online application form. It was pretty extensive, but I didn't have to make 12 photocopies, not connected with paper clips or anything like that. And I thought, I mean, what are the chances? But by some insane miracle, I got this grant. And that, I also learned that if you get a grant and you're a freelancer, you have to pay full freight on your taxes. So I paid a third of my grant in taxes. But that enabled me to really do the research. And then when I was doing Chasing Molecules, again, I had a little bit more of an advance, but it still wasn't very big, and I did the same thing. And I went through every resource on the planet, and I managed to get a $2,500 grant from Oregon Literary Arts, which helped, you know, with some stuff. And then I was feeling really strapped in the middle of this project, and I'm thinking, this is not going to be good. And I just started looking at other books like mine and reading through the acknowledgments and thinking, who have they thanked? Who have they thanked? And I looked at one of Elizabeth Reut's books. She wrote Garbage Land and a book about bottled water. And her work is very similar to mine. And I saw that she thanked this foundation. And I thought, what's the deal? So I sent them an email and I said, I don't know, do you have any programs to which somebody like me could apply? This is what I'm working on. And I got an email back a couple days later that said, thank you for your letter of inquiry. This is when our deadline is. And it was literally at the end of the week. And I thought, well, I haven't written you a letter of inquiry. I just asked if you had a program. And I needed a 501c3 sponsor. So I scrambled around to think, who do I know who's a 501c3 who's not an advocacy group? Because I can't do this with an advocacy group. I thought of SEJ, went back and forth with Beth Park, and I think it was with Beth, and it wasn't really right for SEJ to try and do something like that. And then I thought, oh my gosh, Island Press, they're a nonprofit. So I got all the materials I needed from Island Press to submit what you needed for the grant fund, and I figured, what are the chances? It's really small. It's worth one all-nighter to see if I can get this. And I also, just in the back of my mind, thought, if I didn't have any chance of getting this grant, they wouldn't have asked me if I wanted to put in for it because they would have said, eh, wait till next time or whatever, and I got it.
What was the grant?
It was $15,000.
No, but what was the organization?
It was the Overbrook Foundation. And the tricky thing is that most foundations don't like to support books. They want to do programs. They don't like, and a lot of them very specifically say, no books, no films. And I think I just got really lucky. But the message on that is, leave no stone unturned and must be present to win. So really, I mean, I'm not joking. I mean, really, just comb every possible resource because you never know if your topic somehow is the thing that's sort of sparking somebody's imagination that week. And yeah, I'd never even met these people. I never spoke to them. I don't know them. So
I just want to clarify the question. We're supposed to make this work economically?
Or delude yourself into thinking.
So when I did the first book, you know, I was working under Advance, and you know, it wasn't, you know, I didn't get rich on it, but the Advance was pretty good, and it was good enough that I could take a year and a half off from my newspaper job and focus on the book full time. And now things have changed. They're kind of the exact opposite. So I've taken a buyout from the newspaper, you know, 3 years ago, and I need to take on a bunch of other work on top of the Advance to do this book. So, you know, it's kind of the usual thing. I'm doing, you know, freelance work both as a writer and a photographer and doing some documentary video work. I'm teaching, and, you know, it's kind of, you know, whatever gigs I can get that kind of chink it all together.
Okay, great. I'm just going to ask one more question, and then we'll open it up to the audience, and this is again on the marketing question, which we've sort of started. But I think, you know, once you write the book, of course, then you have to sell the book. And if you have a hope of getting a decent next advance, you know, your publisher will look at your past sales. So it's important to try to sell your book. And so as we've said, the marketing and publicity largely fall upon the author these days. I know for my book, I felt like I had some natural audiences, and I wanted to try to reach them. One is the breast cancer community, and so I have reached out to various breast cancer groups and advocacy groups. I've given away lots of copies of my books, and I'm trying to do some Twitter parties with some of these groups. I am doing guest blogging for these groups, you know, anything to sort of get my name and my book in front of their audience. Some of these groups have offered to pay small honoraria, and that does help. I do know quite a few journalists who are making money, by speaking, and it's really padding their income, kind of substantially, like 20-30% of their income now they're getting from speaking. But one of my friends who's doing this really successfully just, wrote a book, called The End of Money. And so he gets invited to groups of bankers, whereas I get invited to groups of women's health nonprofits. So it's kind of a different, you know, if you're smart, you'd write a book about the economy, about ATM machines. So how do you find and target your readers?
Well, I mean, the topic's a natural one where there's going to be plenty of nonprofit environmental groups that are interested in this topic. So that's where I started. And then I'm fortunate, and I don't know how many of you are at academic institutions, but you know, we have a publicity department, and it's very much in their interest for me to be out there. And there's a science communicator, Josh Brown, who's fantastic. He really has been essential in making those contacts with people like Living on Earth, you know, bigger markets that is going to be very hard for me to break through. So that has been very helpful. That, and then targeting sort of Earth Day. You know, there's an Endangered Species Day that doesn't rise to the top, but Earth Day does. And I was in Brazil and got flown back for a couple of talks at that point. So there's probably something following with the calendar. And then the only other recommendation would be if you do have an organization, they're interested in getting you out there. And they've, University of Vermont did much more than Harvard University Press to help publicize them.
I think with all of my books, there have been natural audiences among environmental and other kind of social advocacy groups, environmental health groups, outdoors groups when it was the book about rivers and Lewis and Clark, The Lewis and Clark Trail book was published by Sierra Club Books, which was in the process of being absorbed by California University Press when it came out. And they, I remember I said, well, are you going to do some kind of email press release and say, oh, we wouldn't do that. People would think we were spamming them. So that's sort of where they were. But then Sierra Club, with whom I had nothing to do during the writing of the book, they had this big campaign for the bicentennial of Lewis and Clark expedition. And so they said, well, you go on the road for us if we set stuff up. So I flew to Omaha, got a one-way rental car, and made stops in, I will not take up our whole time telling you how many places I stopped, where, you know, the local Audubon and Sierra Club groups, who in a lot of places, in the, particularly in the eastern end of the trail, were together, did these slideshows, and then I would get in the car and drive myself to the next place, and I felt like, you know, some kind of, like, bad rock band without the groupies or something, because I would get a call and say, quick, we've got the CBS affiliate in Billings, and I would go in, and I'm not making this up to be sort of entertaining, but I would go in, and I said, okay, like, should I brush my hair? Should I change my clothes? Makeup? Oh, no, just look at the red dot. And I would look at the local anchor who looked like a sunset, and there was me, and that sort of, that happened. So that was sort of unusual. High-tech trash and chasing molecules. It turns out there are a lot of industry groups. I had no idea. I was really naive. I had written a book that was ideal for the electronics recycling industry that was just taking off. So I got invited to all these business conferences. Well, there was one recycler in Fresno, California, that bought 700 copies of my book and asked me to sign every single one. And later I can tell you the story of that, which was another comic event. And then another recycler who was really an upscale outfit that was based in Nashville and Dallas and someplace else in the Southeast and was doing work for these big Fortune 500 companies asked me to go to this Gartner Asset Management Conference. And I said, can I pay the registration fee? It was $1,495. And they bought like 200 copies of my book. And then there were all these state agencies that were interested in this stuff. And with Chasing Molecules, the pollution prevention roundtables, the organizations of state agencies that work on emerging contaminants, those are my audiences. And I have sold quite a lot of books, and I've gone to a lot of events. Mostly I've not been paid a penny for any of these things, but they've paid for the transportation and so forth. And this has all been done completely independently of the publisher. The other thing I did with Chasing Molecules, for which the publisher did practically zip in terms of getting me out there, was anytime I knew I was going to be someplace like Michael, I would say, okay, I'm going to the Bay Area. There are all these nonprofits working on environmental health issues, and I would call them up, and I did the same thing in D.C., you know, and I went in and I sort of set up brown bag lunches and I talked to the groups. And then I ended up, like Florence, doing a lot of, would you please do a guest blog for us? And the book really did sort of get out like that. But again, I wasn't paid for this. The publisher didn't do it. But finding that sort of core audience has really sort of been key, because even 2 years after Chasing Molecules come out, I still get asked to come and talk because I've written something that is front and center to these people's, you know, mission. So, I mean, preaching to the choir seems to be a really key thing, whether it's fishermen or environmental health advocates.
I've kind of been a hybrid of all those things. I've done some speaking and gotten honoraria, not a ton, and I've done a ton of free events if I really thought I was going to sell books. I'm kind of in that weird world of, I see myself as kind of an investigative environmental reporter, but I have these kind of adventurous topics. And so I have a fairly built-in audience in, you know, the adventure world. I mean, there's plenty of, climbing groups and people that are interested in fire that will have you speak about those topics. And I kind of saw my role as trying to expand this to other groups, here's a surprising way in which, what I'm reporting on, is tied to you guys. A lot of that is, writing a lot or producing a lot of content, while the book is out, New York Times op-eds or op-eds anywhere, on a topic. Maybe it relates to a certain region of the country, and if you've got a book out, you can contact, a regional paper and say, hey, you guys have just had a really bad fire season, and I've got this whole interesting take that's coming out in my book, and, are you interested in me writing a short op-ed, even though it's before the the book comes out. I had one experience. So I actually write in my book, you know, towards the end of it in 2008, you know, when the Olympics came to China, China paved the road all the way to base camp on Mount Everest. And, you know, various outlets kind of wrote about, you know, what a travesty this was. And so I contacted the New York Times and said, you know, it's interesting. However, you know, you should be aware that they've already built a hotel and there's cell service all the way to the summit. And actually this whole area is, you know, really developed. It's not a wilderness. You know, everybody's presenting it in these news stories as if you're paving this wilderness, and it's actually been kind of completely overrun by mountaineers forever. And, you know, the paved road is probably the least of the impacts that we've had. And they really liked that idea. And so I said, hey, I got this op-ed, and I sent a note to the publisher, and they're going, well, you know, your book doesn't come out for 9 months, and this doesn't really help us now. Can you get them to hold the op-ed until your book is out? And I just thought, you know, you're a publisher in New York. You kind of ought to know how the news business works. And no, they want this tomorrow. But a lot of things like that I find really helpful. And then, you know, as I said, I've got, you know, kind of an inherent advantage, and in that I'm a photographer and videographer, and I make a lot of multimedia content. And you know, for my current book project, you know, Houghton is the reality is, at least from my experience and the publishers I've interviewed with, is they are more in the dark than we are about what's going to happen with the publishing industry, and they're looking for answers. And so, you know, the big talk at least a year ago was enhanced ebooks, and I don't know if you've looked at like Our Choice, Al Gore's book on the iPad, and the Elements. They did a really cool enhanced ebook with, and I think it really behooves all of us to look at that stuff, even if you're not that interested in producing that content, but understanding a lot of the options that were out there, because I really was able, when I met with Houghton, they really liked all the multimedia content that I have, and they don't really know what form that's going to take, but they really want to start doing more high-tech books with, you know, all kinds of links and things, and, you know, on electronic publishing platforms. So, you know, a couple of pieces of advice in that is, if you are going to work in multimedia in whatever formats, learn to love metadata, you know, and learn to love it now, you know, so that, you know, you've got GPS coding on all this content and any other tagging that you think is going to be helpful, so that whenever we figure out what this platform is, you're plugging and playing this stuff. As opposed to my last book, where I had, you know, probably 10 years of photos and video and stuff from the Himalaya, and I thought I was reasonably organized. But as opportunities came for multimedia things and book trailers and all these kinds of things, you know, I spent weeks ripping my hair out in the middle of the night. Where the hell did I put that file of photos? My God, you know. You can make all of this new media stuff easy or hard. And it's something I love, and it's really fun, but being really organized up front, and, you know, using a lot of the programming that we have now to keep this stuff organized and easy to plug into whatever they decide to do is really, really helpful.
Okay, one word takeaway, metadata. Write that down. But I've been told by Jay that we can go a little bit into the break since we started late. I'd like to open it up, and I'm supposed to take questions from SEJ members first. And please state your name and affiliation with your question.
It happens, and I mean, I guess in my case, to some degree, I already have been. I mean, a lot of the last book was published in, you know, the blogs online, and I was just talking yesterday to some folks about some of the legal issues where, you know, I had a blog and then the villain is responding in his own blog and these things are going back and forth and I want to use all that stuff. So I think that you need to have all those things on the table. I have a friend that wrote a cookbook called Clean Food. And she self-published it, and she basically had some money, and she went to her financial advisor, who she'd had for a really long time, and, you know, investments weren't doing well, and his suggestion was, why don't you, you know, you've been talking about doing a book, why don't you invest in yourself and invest this in doing your book? And so she thought, wow, that's unusual advice from somebody who makes money off me investing with him, so I'll do that. And she wrote this really pretty cool cookbook and self-published it. And about a year later, it did fairly well, and she got contacted by a very major publisher that does cookbooks, and they bought the rights to her cookbook. And they published it as a, you know, very spiffy, well-done cookbook. And then I saw her about a year later and said, hey, you know, congratulations, that really worked out well for you. And she goes, you know, not really. I was really much happier when I was self-publishing it, and I think I'll self-publish my next cookbook. Mm-hmm. You know, that, you know, once she got involved with the publisher, you know, all of the clever things she was doing to market her own book, she had to get approval on, and a lot of those things they weren't willing to do anymore. And she said, you know, I was, you know, getting into the big publishing machine really kind of squeezed the joy out of it for me, and I was doing fine just self-publishing it. So I think all of those things are really good ideas, and that there's a lot of things on the table. I think it's, you know, before you go into it, do a lot of reporting on what the options are and how they're working out for people, and, you know, call other people that are using these platforms up and, you know, find out what's working for them and figure out what the mix is for you. What's increasingly clear to me is that if you really want to do books and multimedia projects like this, you're going to have to drive them. You're going to have to come to the publisher with a pretty defined idea of how it's going to work and know, you know, stuff that they don't know. And you're going to have to be reasonably forceful and have some good leverage to make this happen according to your vision. Because they, like, again, they really don't know what's going to happen with the publishing industry. And, you know, speaking from, you know, being a refugee from the newspaper industry, frightened industries make bad decisions. So, you know, try to make as many of those decisions yourself as you can.
That can work in your favor. It's not even.
So when I was in newspapers, I had a friend, a really good writer, and he said, the best writing you have to do is the slug line for the story. The, you know, the hardest read you're going to get is the editors. And I think that's, you know, doubly true in books. So your marketing machine starts before you write the book proposal, and you're marketing it to the publisher. You've got a list of ideas that you've got. Half of them are going to fall off the page, or the world's going to change, and we're not doing this. Pardon? For how you promote the book. I had the last book, I had a whole section on promotion. They actually were in contact with my agent, who was sending them video clips of me from the Himalaya and me on other TV shows and from other things I've done, and you know, all kinds of other things. And all of that was marketing. You know, that, you know, for one thing, I was kind of blown away in that all of my last book, all of the interviews, they would start asking me how telegenic I was.
Oh, God.
It's like, well, what the hell does that have to do with the content of this book? So, yeah, I think, you know, and it'll make a huge difference. I mean, you know, they're looking for personalities that they can put out there, and that will have an impact over the kind of advance you get.
And I have I have a slightly different take on that, because since I wasn't doing something that was going to be a telegenic event, particularly with my last two books, they are really content heavy. I concentrated really hard, especially since I was writing on topics that weren't really clear from the outset, probably to anybody beyond maybe the first editor I contacted, that it was actually going to be a read. So I concentrated really hard in my proposal on describing the whole arc of the book so somebody would get this obscure thing that I was trying to do. But I also knew in the back of my mind that I was going to have to be prepared to answer, who's going to want to read this book? And I was going to have to come up with that list of groups that I kind of mentioned before, or audiences. And I definitely did not put them in my proposal, but they were definitely part of what I had to be prepared to share in terms of who's going to want to read this book that we're not even sure what this topic is, because no one's ever written about it before. And I can tell you for sure, no one asked me if I was telegenic.
Yeah, just very quickly about that. And I think we're all terrible about it. I'm terrible about it. You should really be gathering photos and video of yourself working and at sites, and you know, when you're speaking, try to, look, we all hate that. You know, I'm much more comfortable on the other side of the camera, but that stuff is really valuable. It really will help you sell the book. It will help you sell them that, you know, we should really support you in doing book talks and things like that. So make sure to
smile.
Yeah, there we go.
Gosh. Okay, Tony. Oh, can you say who you are and where you're
My
my wife said, no, don't write
it. Don't ask.
And the second, the next one is even more, she's more against it. So. I didn't get that much. I mean, friends are supportive, but I think it more started, I guess, through colleagues was more the way the connections were made.
But you're the one who's going to have to live with this, pain and suffering for the next few years. And it's really, it's a tough decision that's got to be, I think.
So I was in a, the enviable situation of being in a dying industry when I got my book proposal. I worked for a Tribune newspaper, and we had a series of layoffs and buyouts, leading up to when I got it. And I actually found that, my peers and colleagues saw it as like, wow, there are opportunities. Maybe it isn't going to be so horrible. Maybe I'm not going to end up panhandling. So I got an immense amount of support. People were, I got a lot of pats on the back. And, I also, kind of had come from a photo background. So there were just a lot of people like, wow, I know he writes for us and stuff, but actually, he got a book contract. He actually can write. There's another point to make in that, at least for me. I really miss being in a newsroom. I'm the guy who, like, the first day walked into a newspaper, I thought, that you're going to take me out of this place in a casket. It's the coolest place I've ever seen in my life. And so seeing that was really sad for me. And then being isolated while I'm writing a book was really challenging. So they talked a bit about it in the freelancing workshop the other day. I found it really critical to kind of create my digital virtual newsroom and have a bunch of people that I could send questions to. There are investigative parts of my book. Like I have a chapter that investigates, charities that work overseas tied to sports. And I have a friend who's an investigative reporter who had done some investigation on charities tied to, the Gulf War. And so, I would have, when I was writing that, like once a week we'd have lunch together, or I'd end up back at the newsroom sitting on his desk showing how to crunch these numbers and how to get information that, that I needed, but, so that I could do it myself. And I could have figured out how to do that. It took me more time to go and visit him and learn from him, but it was really helpful to me just to go and see folks and, get reminded every once in a while that, you can do this work. I worked at the Hartford Courant.
I think we probably just have time for one more question. So before I take it, I'd just like to thank you for coming and thank our panelists. And I want to put a plug in for all of our books, which are, I guess, not on sale today, unfortunately, but are on sale tomorrow at the Wind Museum. And they are all available from multiple venues and websites.
Actually, my book isn't on sale because it's not recently released, but you can all contact me, and I'm totally happy to sell them, and the signature's free.
Okay. Yes.
I'll say I did a lot of that because that was really the best way I could think of to sort of finance the research. And I don't think in the end I have any chapters or part of chapters that are exactly as magazine stories appeared, but I used some of the same material in different forms. I don't have anything that is like a whole article that then got lifted into the book. And publishers love it if they can say, parts of this book or, she's been published in. And after Chasing Molecules came out, the publisher did sell an excerpt to Scientific American online, which was sort of a condensed version of one of the chapters. But publishers generally love it because that means they can say that you've been published in some outlets with a built-in audience. So I didn't have any restrictions, but I think if you were trying to pick up a whole article and insert it in your book, you would have to check on sort of copyright issues and
that's,
stuff like that.
That's a negotiation to have up front, and I had that negotiation directly with this book. And so what you want to do for that is you want to keep serial rights. And in this case, I also kept international rights. My last book, maybe got translated into like 6 languages, but we were actually a little disappointed that they didn't follow up with some other countries that we really thought they'd get sales in. And you're not seeing a ton of money out of that, but it adds up, it's a little bit. And in some cases, your contracts will have, little bonuses if you sell a certain amount of foreign rights, et cetera. Maintaining serial rights is really important. And I've had the same experience that Lizzie had. a little different in that the publisher and my agent have warned me repeatedly, you know, don't give it away in magazine articles. But I'm writing a whole series on this stuff, and I've never had an article go where they weren't thrilled that they got the traction. They might ask you to wait until your book comes out on something or till close
Joe,
to
Joe, do you want to?
I think it's the best form of advertising. So,
yeah.
You know, that's better than, you know, paying for something.
I think it's a careful strategic decision, you know, because I did 4 excerpts right when my book came out, and it really helped generate publicity for the book. So that's the problem. If you can stretch your advance out that far. Thank you all for coming. I think I'll be available during the next couple days.